to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. A victim of the Manchester Arena terror attack calls for MI5 to be prosecuted for negligence. A litany of failures, which again and again and again, we're talking 7-7, we're talking the Westminster Bridge attack, the London Bridge attack, the Manchester attack, again and again and again have allowed bombers to carry on unhindered. Or is MI5's work impossible, like looking for a needle in a haystack? If so, why are we paying them any money? The cyber war against you, being waged using your taxpayers' money. A former GCHQ officer explains methods by which the deep state, operating in the shadows, has taken away any oversight whatsoever of the intelligence services, even from the Queen. Off with his head. Also, following on from last week, other high-profile political targets who died in car crashes. We get the latest on the taking offline and attempts to prosecute the world's most courageous publisher and investigative journalist. Yes, we're talking about Julian Assange. Almost unreported, this one. The US refuses to vote for a UN motion condemning Nazi war criminals and neo-Nazis today. Plus, Martin Summers' tour of the world's hotspots, he's able to do if he wishes. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM Tuesday at noon. This week we look at Westmoreland House, some artwork which has been done to celebrate the beginning of the end of an eyesore on Stokes Croft. It's the demolition's just started. There's some art available if you're interested, some artworks on that, a screen print about it. And one of the people who started the Greenham Common protests in Berkshire in the 1980s, Fran D'Arth. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday to Dialect, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk right now. But Martin, I think we better start with this attack, the Manchester Arena attack. I mean, what's your general take home from what happened that day?
Well, I think the most significant thing that people haven't really picked up on, or they ought to pick up on, is that the Islamic Fighting Group of Libya, or the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, basically were headquartered in Manchester during the 1980s when they were being shipped to Afghanistan to fight the Red Army, having been trained basically by our own intelligence services and special forces.
In what way were they related to Libya then?
Well, because
they're going over to Afghanistan.
Well, the bomber, the alleged bomber, if we can call him that, was a member of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, as was his father, who made a statement in Tripoli about what had happened, saying that the whole thing was a setup and that the whole thing was being orchestrated from inside the Western intelligence services. Now, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group is very significant because the Libyans provided by far the largest...
You're talking about Ramadan Abadi, yeah? This is the guy who was in the Islamic Fighting Group. We know he was working for MI6, so it's not really much of an excuse to have an MI6 agent... And his son carries out a bombing, and the intelligence services are telling us they didn't know anything about it.
Well, I mean, what the father was saying before he was disappeared, and we don't know where, I'm not quite sure what's happened to him, is that he was in the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. He'd been working, because they've been working intimately with MI6 for years and years and years, going back to the 1980s, both in opposition to Gaddafi and, of course, operating in Afghanistan in the 80s. And, of course, lots of them were then transferred to Syria after Gaddafi was overthrown in Libya. And people people have got to know the background and the history. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group are Al-Qaeda Libya, but they have an intimate relationship with MI6 and, of course, with MI5 indirectly. So the idea that these people are just random is just wrong. They are there, based in Manchester, because Manchester was basically made as the, you know, the ex-Libyan place where they were going to be. So all these people from Libya lived in Manchester with the full understanding of the Western intelligence services, particularly our own in Britain.
Well, he was detained by the militia, Ramadan Abadi, Salman Abadi's father.
Yeah.
Not been heard of since.
Well, indeed. And, of course, he was saying that the whole thing is actually orchestrated because he's an insider. He's a Libyan Islamic Fighting Group guy, and he also works with MI6. And he immediately pointed the finger at MI6 for being behind the bombing. So when we're talking about MI5 being lacking in capacity to stop bombs and all the rest of it, you're missing the point. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group is a terrorist organisation, but it's been set up, run and directed by MI6 since the 1980s. So we're talking 50 years of relations with MI6.
So is there actually any evidence that Salman Abadi, CCTV, that sort of thing, was even at the Manchester Arena?
Well, these questions start to emerge, don't they? What actually happened here?
Well, the answer is no. What the security services have released are several pictures with all the edges blacked out. So it's a picture of Salman Abadi with a suitcase of some sort, and all you can see around the edges is black. So it doesn't actually show any evidence.
Yeah,
that he was there.
Unless you've got a time-stamped video, taken, then it doesn't mean anything.
These were taken apparently in a lift in the centre, but they blacked everything else out because they didn't want to show other people's faces.
Well, unless you've got a time-stamped video, it doesn't mean anything, does it? I mean, people think they saw the bombers on 7/7 on video, but it was from the dry run the previous week.
There was nothing shown around the Salman Abadi's body other than black, so you couldn't see anyone else's, not even parts of a lift. It was really impossible to see where he was.
Well, it may well be that the whole thing is a false flag terrorist attack, or it may be blowback. You know, you could argue, I think people on RT have argued, that basically you shouldn't have been in bed with the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. Looks what happens when you work with these kind of people. They were anti-Gaddafi, they were anti-Russian, therefore they were on our side even though they're Al-Qaeda. But of course it could be blowback, but I think it's more suspicious than that. Orchestrating the whole of the strategy of tension before 9/11 and after 9/11 has been Western Intelligence Services, in which MI6 are big players. They're as big players in many ways as the CIA.
But that's ridiculous. I mean, surely our own security services wouldn't get involved in an attack which killed 22 of our own people.
They would if it then led to a situation where everybody's screaming, oh, we're being bombed here, give some more resources to the security services so they can carry on doing other things elsewhere. Don't forget that the purpose of all of this is to carry on wars in the Middle East and elsewhere for resources. And the 9/11 attack itself looks like a false flag. The bombing of Bologna railway station in 1980 was a false flag. The bombs in Dublin and Monaghan in 1972 were false flag, according to the Italian and Irish police in both cases. Now, in actual fact, unless you know the history of Western intelligence service false flag terrorism, you might say, "Well, surely the intelligence services are trying to catch the bombers." Not necessarily. Not necessarily at all.
Well, there was a whole list of problems with, and it'd be interesting to see, you know, what the Intelligence and Security Committee say about any of these, and we'll come to that in a minute. But we had helplines inoperative. Actually, that day there was supposed to be an automatic helpline, but it didn't give any useful information. And since Vodafone have apologised to the Home Office and saying, "Well, we thought we were going to have a helpline. It was supposed to be ready, but unfortunately, on the night of the attack and the next day, it didn't work."
Well, interestingly enough, the fire brigade are also complaining because they weren't given access to the scene. Now, that possibly means that somebody is cleaning the scene to make sure that outsiders can't see what's actually happened.
Well, what was said is that there was supposed to be another bomber or something, so the fire brigade were told, hang on a minute, just stay back and don't come near the attack scene. Also, another thing which happens often is these false alarm of second terrorists, giving the police and private security total control of the terror attack crime scene, which is what you've just said there. Key eyewitnesses are not interviewed, or frozen out or neglected. Now, we heard, didn't we, from Dawn Waddy, who said that she saw a very suspicious woman who wasn't actually at, who was at the concert sitting next to her, but wasn't paying any attention to it and kept looking at where the bomb eventually went off. She had a rucksack that she kept fiddling with, and she wasn't actually watching the concert. She had no interest in it, and she had some sort of foreign accent.
Well, I would make the point, fundamental point, that we've got overwhelming evidence from the past that NATO intelligence services have engaged in terrorist provocations.
So what about the security people on this occasion, in charge? It does seem that they ignored warnings. Private security at the arena could actually be potentially a terror vector.
Well, indeed, when you've privatised security in things like airports, ICTS, an Israeli firm connected to Mossad, controlled all three airports on 9/11, where hijackers supposedly got on planes, and also controlled Schiphol Airport today, where the underpants bomber and the shoe bomber were both allowed on the plane without being checked. Now, in actual fact, most terrorism is orchestrated by security forces. Some of it is random, but most of it isn't.
Salman Abedi, who's the alleged bomber, I would suggest most likely Patsy for this attack. Mm-hmm. He was reported to the anti-terror hotline several times, apparently. And he was well known, obviously, to the security services through his father working for mm-hmm. them. And yet there was nothing done to stop him.
Well, what you need to do if you're...
what's the point of phoning the anti-terror hotline about somebody who's about to carry out a terrorist attack?
I would suggest to anybody listening to this show, and the point I made in Birmingham Central Mosque some years ago, is if you suspect somebody is a terrorist, you shouldn't contact the anti-terror hotline. You should contact the local police, because they can then filter what's going on. The fact of the matter is, I'm afraid, that intelligence services, the higher up you go, are suspects. And therefore, you shouldn't be working directly with them.
We'll be coming to that in a minute. So basically, phone 101, folks. Don't phone the anti-terror hotline.
Quite.
Rather, potentially anyway, a waste of time. Anyway, somebody who was really irritated about this whole business, he was severely injured in the attack. His name's Robbie Potter. And he thinks that MI5 should be sued over the revelations, that they knew so much and been following this guy, and he had so many connections, and they've been warned so many times. He's wondering, what on earth is the point of MI5? But anyway, he's saying they should be taken to court. And here he is speaking to the BBC's Judith Moritz.
Abedi was never referred to the government's anti-radicalisation programme Prevent and was able to visit another extremist in prison. Robbie Potter was gravely injured in the attack, left in a coma with shrapnel removed from his heart. Today, he's on the mend, but angry at the revelations.
This is something that could have been stopped. End of. This did not have to happen. Every alarm bell was ringing.
You feel let down?
I am a bit, yeah. There was enough warning signs. It wasn't just like one like hoax call to him. There's enough warning signs. They should be took to court. Yeah, I've said it. They should be took to court now. They're just as guilty. That could have been stopped.
MI5?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's an absolutely fair comment from that gentleman. But I come back to what we were saying earlier. The real problem is that the intelligence structure is implicated in Islamist terrorism and has been since the 1980s.
But what Robbie Potter is saying there is this attack could have been stopped and should have been stopped. So why wasn't it? I mean, what we have with the security services, Martin, is a whole bunch of secret officers who are able to be interviewed by the Intelligence and Security Committee behind closed doors, but it's all totally anonymous and they don't face prosecution. We also saw a story earlier on this year which said that the MI5 are actually allowed to break the law and commit crimes with impunity.
Well, and anybody thought that anything else was the case, I've got a suspension bridge to tell you. The Western intelligence services, including MI6, the CIA, etc., are extremely iffy organisations. They always have been. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group is based in Manchester because MI6 based them there in the 1980s. And that, what are we on now? 2018? That's nearly 50 years ago. And they've been working with them very closely all that time, which is why they know everything about this guy, and they didn't stop it because they didn't want to stop it. So, and it's not even clear he did it, as you said earlier.
The story is in The Guardian from the 2nd of March this year. MI5 agents can commit crimes in the UK, the government reveals, and the officers obviously as well. Secret order on authorised criminality by spies has been made public after a legal battle by rights groups. MI5 officers are allowed to carry out criminal activity. The government's acknowledged for the first time. The Prime Minister on Thursday was forced to publish the text of a direction to the Investigatory Powers Commissioner's Office, the spying watchdog on governing security service participation in criminality. It instructs the IPCO to oversee the participation of MI5 agents in criminal activity, which was previously conducted by the now defunct Office of the Intelligence Services Commissioner under a secret order referred to as the Third Direction.
Well, the fact is that they've been doing, they've been engaged in criminal activities for years.
And I'll put that
It's hardly surprising. This is just a bit of an admission.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But anyway, let's hear from the Home Affairs correspondent of the BBC, Dominic Cacciani. I suppose before that, we should give a kind of, I suppose, a warning, really, saying, well, you know, take this with a pinch of salt. After we spoke to the former Special Branch officer and Army officer, Charles Shoebridge, Martin, who said that actually the London media's Home Affairs correspondents are basically press officers for MI5.
That's right, that's total integration.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, you don't end up being in that position if you're going to be problematic from the point of view of the securocrats that run things.
Okay, so problematic. Let's have a listen to Dominic Cacciani now on BBC's 5 Live yesterday.
What the Intelligence and Security Committee has said today very explicitly is that, in their view, MI5 has admitted that it made a mistake in not tracking Salman Abedi, the Manchester bomber. And let me just take you back a little bit, because I think there's a bit of history around the Abedi case. Mm. He was initially a person of concern to MI5. He first came onto their radar in 2014 when they received some intelligence which suggested that the then teenager was of a cause of concern. They had a look at him. They decided actually that at that time he wasn't at the threshold to be some kind of potential terrorist in the making. That happens with an awful lot of people who come across MI5's radar. So they, in their view, they can't justify spending any more time on that individual because there are, to be frank, bigger fish to fry. What then happened, I think, is very, very interesting. They started to receive bits and pieces of possible intelligence in relation to Salman Abedi, and a decision was taken to review his case about whether or not effectively to reopen his file and turn him into one of their priority cases to look at. But the review meeting, which would have taken that decision, wasn't actually scheduled until actually after the bombing took place. And critically, Abedi, who's believed to have received his bomb-making training from Islamic State or another group in Libya, he flew back into the country days before the attack. There was no flag against him so that he would be stopped at the airport and questioned and his devices cloned and examined. So there was a potential opportunity missed there. The security service have effectively conceded to MPs that port stop probably should have been in place. Now, whether or not it would have stopped an attack, given how close it was a matter of days later that he built his bomb and carried it out his attack. We don't know. But another key piece of the picture, which became much clearer today, is the fact that Abedi, we knew already that he had visited a known jailed extremist in prison in the UK, a guy from Manchester called Abdul Rauf Abdallah, and the committee makes clear today that visit was not passed on to the security service, MI5. They weren't aware that visit took place. And
I mean, one does wonder what MI5 get up to, and they seem to know so little about somebody like this. Martin, the other thing here is they're now saying that he was the bomb maker, although in the beginning, certainly for the first few months, there was no idea that he had any kind of bomb making skills whatsoever and that someone else must have been involved. But this is all very convenient because the person who's now supposed to have been the bomb maker, making a bomb within just a couple of days of coming into the UK and exploding it, is dead.
Well, indeed. And of course, it just raises more questions than answers, does it not? I would suggest that a bomb like that is unlikely to have been made by an individual. It's quite likely that there's a group involved. But if there's a group involved, then the explanation that we've been given about what happened doesn't stack up. And I come back to what I was saying earlier. My suspicion is that behind not just this attack, but the 7/7 attack and certainly the 9/11 attack and many other of these attacks, they're being orchestrated from within the Western intelligence services. And I know some people may be shocked to hear that, but they shouldn't be, because the reality is that's what's been going on for over 50 years.
Martin, it was also Parsons Green attack. That was the last year too. The MI5 only delivered all their papers that the Intelligence and Security Committee had been wanting yesterday. So the same day as they were supposed to be, these MPs were supposed to be telling us all about what happened on the Parsons Green attack, that's when this massive box of paperwork arrived from MI5. It doesn't sound as if they're actually cooperating with the Members of Parliament.
No, and you could argue, I mean, you know, on one level it sounds as if they're trying to cover up the fact that they're incompetent and they didn't catch people and so on and so forth. But I think it's more sinister than that, frankly. If you know the history of their relationship with Al-Qaeda, with the Islamic Fighting Group in Libya and others, and what's been going on in Syria over the last 5 or 6 years, where it's absolutely clear that British Special Forces have been cooperating with Islamist terrorists to carry out bomb attacks of various kinds. And that's what we pay our taxes for. Folks, don't kid yourself, that's the real world.
Well, let's try and dig into a bit more behind this screen that's put up by the Intelligence and Security Committee, basically saying things like, MI5 had bigger fish to fry than Salman Abedi, even though he was about to blow up this bomb and allegedly anyway, and possibly just be the patsy for someone else that did it. Mm-hmm. And that his father was working for MI6. So let's have a listen now to Alex Thompson, who's a former GCHQ officer. We had him on this programme, gosh, must be 4 or 5 months ago now, with quite a fascinating look at the privatisation of GCHQ and the intelligence services. And here he's talking to us about intelligence whistleblowers and what they tell us about what's really going on behind the scenes, that the Intelligence and Security Committee MPs have not managed to get any information from MI5 and the rest of them about at all.
Spycatcher by Peter Wright. I'm sure you know all the hoo-ha about that. It was published in the US. He went to live in Australia. He was the number two of MI5. He came up through the scientific route. He was not a public schoolboy. And he could see some things clearer than the old boys' tie network. But he couldn't quite conceive of the City of London and secular Zionism being the thievery, the heart of thievery involved. So there's a key point on page 317 where the absolute A1 Soviet defector, Anatoly Golitsyn, who tells us all about the long-range planning for the Soviets to survive the collapse of their territorial empire and to go into the West in the minds of men, Golitsyn has revealed all this, and Wright, who's number two at MI5, has the privilege of debriefing him and seeing him in person and waving photos in front of him and saying, "Do you remember this guy?" He leaves him, after much internal debate, with MI5's files on who might have been the MI5 mole, who was giving stuff away to the Soviets. And Golitsyn thinks and thinks. And then he comes back and says, "Your spies, Mr. Wright, are here. My methodology has uncovered them," he intoned darkly, pointing his finger like the witch finder at two files on the table in front of him. "I knew the files well. They belonged to Victor Rothschild and Tess Rothschild." "Don't be totally absurd, Anatole," I said. "Victor is one of the best friends MI5 has ever had. How on earth did you jump to that conclusion?" He's not prepared to accept what Golitsyn, the best ever defector, is telling us. This one's in German, Die Deutsche Karte, which means playing the German card, written by a chap who died earlier this year, Hans-Gerd Kommosser, who was head of German military intelligence in the late Cold War. And the key point for him, I won't read this out, it's in German, but the key point is he's got a paragraph about Sir Stuart Mingus, the wartime head of MI6, and he's got an anecdote I've never found in English, which is that during the war, King George VI calls him over and says, "Mingus, what would happen if I were to ask you the name of our man in Berlin?" Mingus answered, "I would have to tell you, sire, that my lips are sealed." "Very good, Mingus. And imagine that I then followed that up by saying, 'Off with his head.' In that case, Your Majesty, my head would roll with my lips still sealed." So this is treason, okay? This is a bunch of people who've taken over under the sovereign, who are saying to the sovereign, "Stuff you don't get read into our intelligence world. It's not there for you, it's for a corporate group." Okay? So the evidence has been there through the decades by these intelligence whistleblowers that there has been an internal cabal which is vaguely overlapping with Britain and America, Israel and South Africa, but which is not in the service of the national interest or the people or the parliaments of any of those nations. There's no oversight of it. And they have formed, basically, an intelligence-sucking mass which is going to be put at the service of the emerging, supposedly EU, but really global corporate shock troops.
So that's Alex Thompson. He's a columnist, regular appearing on something called the UK Column, run by Brian Gerrish, I think out of Plymouth. But Martin, what he's saying there is that actually the intelligence services have arranged themselves so nicely that actually they're far, far closer to the City of London. And he mentioned Tess Rothschild and Victor Rothschild there, far closer to the City of London than they are to any kind of scrutiny by the royals or by our MPs.
Well, of course. I mean, it strikes me as, why is anybody surprised by this? What do you imagine goes on in the real world? In the real world, powerful oligarchs suborn the institutions of the state to do what they want to do. They've been doing it for years. They're still doing it. And the idea that somehow these organisations are there to serve the people or even to serve the Queen is laughable. They're just not there for that. That's not what they're about. The Hambros Bank in the City of London was packed with XMI6 people. The Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which collapsed in the 90s, I think it was. CIA front organisation all the way. The Nugent Hand Bank in Australia. Basically a intelligence service bank. So the intelligence services and the bankers are the same people. It's a revolving door. And that's what they do. They revolve.
So what's the point in having an intelligence and security committee then?
For show, Tony. For show. The pretense that something is actually a constitutional structure, I mean, under some kind of constitutional control, like, when in actual fact it isn't anything of the kind.
7-7, 50 people dying, 22 people in Manchester. How many innocent British people have to die before we get some changes and any kind of proper scrutiny of the intelligence and services? I mean, we're talking particularly here about MI5, who is actually their job to stop this kind of thing.
Well,
happening.
Ultimately, all of these organisations...
Can they be taken
all of these organisations will ultimately have to be disbanded.
Martin, Robbie Potter wants to take them to court. Is that feasible?
I can see why he's saying that, but that might be one line of attack to chip away at them, if you see what I mean.
They always appear behind screens, don't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, Colonel Jay appeared behind a screen in Northern Ireland. It turned out in the end that he was Brigadier Gordon Kerr, and he was in fact running the UDA's Chief Intelligence Officer, Brian Nelson, as one of his agents, and therefore orchestrating the UDA's terror campaign, which killed hundreds of people. But has he been punished? No, he hasn't. There's a panorama programme by John Ware about him, and he was doorstepped in Beijing, but no doubt he's living somewhere high on the hog as a pensioner of the British state, even though it's pretty clear that he's a terrorist.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
News just yesterday, Martin. We've got this chap who's called... what is his name? Matthew Hedges. He's actually a young lad from Durham University. He's just been given life in prison in the UAE.
Yes, well, it's, what's going on there, one may well ask. And one may well ask, why have we got a relationship with the UAE anyway? What sort of democratic votes do they have in the UAE? Oh, they don't have any. In actual fact, the UAE is a created state created by MI6 back in the 1920s. They created all of these nations,
hang on, in the 20s and 30s and 40s, up until the 1950s, actually, that was all Oman, that part of the Gulf.
Well, Oman still exists, of course, but all of these Gulf states...
Bahrain has been created.
All of these Gulf states are basically creations of MI6. They didn't exist before MI6 created them.
Anyway,
and then we talk about having a relationship with them as if they're a foreign country, and they are a foreign country in a way, but they're basically our own creation.
So let's have a listen to Prime Minister's questions where this whole matter came up.
Crispin Blunt!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Durham University PhD student Matthew Hedges was arrested when he was leaving the UAE, having completed his research into the impact of the Arab Spring on the UAE's foreign policy. He has now been sentenced to life imprisonment for spying for the United Kingdom. A number of us will note the irony of a former MI6 officer who works in the outer office of the ruler, of the de facto ruler of the UAE, who has organised many of the excellent visits from this house to the UAE. But this is wholly inconsistent with the behaviour of a nation with whom we have a mutual defence accord. Will the Prime Minister please give this her urgent attention? And if he's not released, I don't see why we should be committed to their defence.
I say to my honourable friend, we are, of course, as he is, deeply disappointed and concerned at today's verdict, and I realise how difficult and distressing this is, both for Matthew Hedges, but for also for his family. We are raising it with the Emirati authorities at the highest level. My right honourable friend, the Foreign Secretary, is urgently seeking a call with the Foreign Minister, Abdullah bin Zayed. During his visit to the UAE on November the 12th, he raised the issue with both Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed and the Foreign Minister, and I can assure my honourable friend and other members that the Foreign Office will remain in close contact with Matthew, his family and his lawyer. We will continue to do all we can to support them as they consider the next steps, and we will continue to press this matter at the highest level with the Emiratis.
It does seem a little bit cheeky for MI6 to send a college kid out there. Can't they actually have someone who's got a little bit of experience if they want to have a spy? One of the things that frustrates me about this whole thing, Martin, is that it's assumed, of course, totally without any kind of balance from the other side, that this guy was perfectly innocent. I mean, all of our media reports on it.
Well, I wouldn't like to judge that. He may be a genuinely independent who's basically been caught up because the UAE don't like his sticking his finger into their business. But, of course, the UAE, as long with Britain and Saudi Arabia, are involved with the massive tragedy in Yemen, where thousands and thousands of people, mostly civilians, are starving to death. They've got cholera. There's a continuous rain of bombs, many of which are built here in Bristol. And we're really worried about this poor old PhD student. It's like the lady in Iran, who Boris Johnson infelicitously said was over there to train journalists, even though she was actually supposedly over there on a holiday. Now, it's quite possible that these people wandering around the place are working for our intelligence services, or they might just be random people caught up in the mess. But the reality is, MI6 works very closely with all of these.
Now, the suggestion here seems to be that Britain is falling out of favour internationally, and that many of these countries, like the UAE, are saying, well, let's grab a few, bag ourselves a few people who we think or know or suspect are working for the British security services and keep them as bargaining chips.
Well, I mean, as you pointed out earlier,
why would they want to do that?
Well, why would they want to do that when they've got somebody seconded from MI6 working at the top of their security structure?
I thought he's a former.
Former, yes. Are there any such things? Is there such a thing as a former MI6 officer? Khashoggi was basically a CIA man, which is why there's been such a lot of fuss about him being murdered in such a horrible way in Turkey.
I suppose what I'm implying here is that actually global tensions are gradually ramping up, and that countries are not trusting Britain or other countries as much as they used to, and that these actually do enable some sort of quid pro quo. So they'll say, the UAE will say, well, we want this off of you, and we'll release this guy if you give it to us.
Quite possibly. That's more than likely what's going on here. But people, if we're going to talk about the UAE, we've got to talk about the UAE's intervention in Yemen. Now, when countries invade other countries, like Soviet Union invading Czechoslovakia, or Saddam Hussein invading Kuwait, or when Serbia, God forbid, tried to keep Kosovo as part of Serbia, we went to war. But now the UAE and Saudi Arabia have invaded Yemen, and not only are we not going to war with Saudi Arabia, we're supporting the aggression, which is killing thousands and thousands of people. At what point is there blowback for behaving like that? And of course, it's not just a question of blowback. Maybe we're orchestrating the whole thing.
Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
Why don't we, I think, move now to have a little look at Israel? Because obviously in the Middle East, that's one of the major problems. There's tension building between them and the Iranians. And I picked up this clip from Miko Peled, who I believe his father was actually a general in the Israeli army. And Miko also served in the Israeli army, but he has become someone who's very outspoken. In fact, he goes around the world speaking, and he's done several books about what he believes is the Israeli genocide and racism towards the Palestinians. And he starts here by talking about the way that there's a brainwashing goes on within Israel of young Israeli children in schools.
There's an education system, the Zionist education system, like Judith alluded, my sister just wrote a book about it, she's an educator, that teaches racism in a very subtle way. There's a bureaucracy, an entire bureaucracy, that is dedicated to making life impossible for Palestinians through all kinds of restrictions and permits and requirements that are absolutely uncalled for and unnecessary, but are all given and provided under the guise of security. And then you've got the Israeli army, which I like to refer to as one of the best trained, best equipped, best fed terrorist organizations in the world. And yes, they have generals and they have nice uniforms, but their entire purpose is terrorism. And just as one example, I'll give you one example. Almost exactly 4 years ago, as Israel began its attack on Gaza, September 27, 2008, at 11:25 in the morning, what I refer to as the most shameful day in the Jewish history, the most shameful day in the history of the Jewish people. Israel began carpet bombing Gaza, and on the first day of what was to be a 21-day attack, they dropped 100 tons of bombs. Okay, a one-ton bomb will decimate an entire city block. Gaza is one of the most densely populated places in the world. 800,000 children live in Gaza. 11:25 is exactly the time when the morning school shift and the afternoon school shift change. So all the kids are in the streets. All the children are on the streets. That was the moment decided by the decision makers in Israel to begin the attack. This was the first day of a 21-day slaughter that had absolutely no justification. If that's not terrorism, I don't know what is. And this is how the state of Israel manages to control the different populations and somehow still keep up this very sweet liberal kind of face to everything. But we still have to figure out how we go from here. Well, let's look at what happened in South Africa. They got rid of apartheid. That is the example. What did they do in America? They got rid of the racist laws that existed in the South. Did the whites in South Africa want this, like this? Absolutely not. Did the whites in the southern states in America, here in the United States, want this or like this? No. It was not done by consensus. But Zionism, just like racism, has to go. The Zionist state has to be replaced with a democracy. Equal rights. We have 5.5 million Palestinians, about 6.5 million Israelis. There's absolutely no reason in the world why they can't live together as equals.
Well, that's Miko Peled there, whose father was a general. He himself served in the Israeli forces, and he's now disgusted. He calls the IDF one of the most powerful terrorist forces in the world, certainly the most powerful in the Middle East.
Well, not just, I mean, obviously he's talking about, the attacks on Gaza by aeroplanes or whatever, but also Mossad are heavily involved in the kind of false flag terrorism we were talking about earlier. For example, cooperating with terrorist groups inside Syria, just as our own intelligence services do. And don't forget the Israeli state was founded by terrorists. The Irgun, the Haganah, they were terrorists. They blew things up, they killed people, and they got the state they wanted, and that's how that state was created.
Well, while we're talking about Israel, Tommy Robinson, and I say that because it's actually a pro-Israel think tank that funds Tommy Robinson's legal costs, has been appointed as UKIP's grooming gang's advisor. Leader Gerald Batten gives his role to anti-Islam activists, shifting the party towards the far right. He's not actually allowed to join UKIP because Tommy Robinson is part of, whether it's the EDL or whatever it is part of an organisation that UKIP have banned. No one is allowed from those organisations to join UKIP, but he is allowed to be appointed as UKIP's grooming gang advisor. And now this was against the wishes of the National Executive because he's a direct advisor to Gerald Batten. The National Executive of UKIP were about to vote overwhelmingly to block Tommy Robinson, but Gerald Batten has decided he's not interested in that. Now, talking to some of the UKIP people, Martin, it looks like they may well split over this, but certainly it's paralysed it at the time of Brexit. And also Nigel Farage has condemned Gerald Batten for taking Tommy Robinson on.
Well, Tommy Robinson, of course, if you remember, he left the EDL and then he claimed that he was working with the Quilliam Foundation, who are supposedly moderate Muslims. And do you know what I think all of this is? I think all of it is shadow play by the intelligence services. They're creating Islamist terrorism, they're creating far-right terrorism, and they're creating all of the conflicts in society which then justify the police state that they really want to have and where we're probably going to end up unless we wake up.
UK church has boycotted companies profiting from Israel's occupation of Palestine. Well, you don't often hear much about the Quakers, but the Quakers, I confess my interest, I'm a Quaker, boycotted any companies that are making money out of the Israeli occupation of Palestine, Martin. That's just this
week. It's a straw in the wind. What the Israeli government is pretty...
It's the first British church to do it, though.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's probably the first of many. The Israelis now basically are facing the potential for an international boycott. I mean, if we're going to have sanctions on Russia and sanctions on Serbia and sanctions on goodness knows who, there's absolutely no reason why we can't have sanctions on Israel. It's a subsidy state. It survives only because US taxpayers chuck loads of money at it. If they all had to work for a living, they'd soon find that they'd change their attitude.
Also, the Israeli envoy's appearance at a London university has been shelved over security concerns. That's Mark Regev, who was going to be talking at City University in London yesterday night, was shelved. That's just earlier this week. I think that was probably Wednesday night he was supposed to be speaking there, but he couldn't go because he thought that he might be attacked, I guess. Israel is going to take Airbnb to court because Airbnb has excluded West Bank settlements from its website. That's on Tuesday, Martin.
Well, that's, and again, a straw in the wind. And of course, ultimately, there's a very hard line, just about majority amongst Jews in Israel for taking a very hard line on everything and expanding their territory and all the rest of it. And the only answer to that, as the guy said earlier, is it's not necessarily going to be consensual. We're going to cut off your aid, we're going to cut off your trade, we're going to cut off all military supplies, and if you want to carry on being a garrison state, you're going to starve.
Also, Israel is the most dangerous country in the Middle East. This is actually the former Dutch Prime Minister saying this. This is around about this time last year. The former Prime Minister's name is Dries van Agt, and he says that they have a range of nuclear bombs and the most dangerous country in the Middle East by far.
Well, a defence intellectual, Martin von Krevelt, in Israel, years ago said, what the Europeans have got to understand is that we can deliver a nuclear bomb on Berlin, Rome, Paris, or wherever. So that if you're talking about people threatening us, that's who's threatening
us. That's MiddleEastMonitor.com, also saying this week that the tide is turning. Israel is losing on two war fronts. The botched Israeli military operation in the Gaza Strip on the 12th of November is delineating Tel Aviv's failure to utilise its army as a tool to achieve Palestinian political concessions. Now that the Palestinian popular resistance has gone global through the exponential rise and growing success of boycott, divestment and sanctions, the Israeli government is fighting two desperate wars and losing them both.
And they're also losing in Syria, where the deployment of the SS-300s to the Syrian Arab Army means that they've been unable to carry out any airstrikes whatsoever since they shot down the Russian
plane. S-300s that shoot down Israeli planes in Israeli airspace, those S-300s will be taken out by the Israelis.
Well, except that they haven't dared to risk it. Because let's see, it's going to be testing Russian kit against Israeli kit. And don't forget, the Russians are quite a long way away. The Israelis are going to take the casualties, isn't it?
Going on now to look at Julian Assange. We did talk last week a bit about Michael Hastings, the journalist who was investigating John Brennan, the head of the CIA, when his car mysteriously accelerated up to 85 miles an hour and swerved into a tree, even though he has his foot on the brakes. He was working for Rolling Stone magazine, and he'd written books as well. Michael Hastings, almost certainly, it looks like, killed in a hacked car attack. But also there's a guy called Danny Jewenko, Martin. Do you want to tell us a bit about him? He died in a very mysterious car crash.
No.
He was a Dutch controlled demolition expert.
Ah, yes, I'm trying to remember who he was, yeah. Well, I mean, given all the things we've been saying about the Western intelligence services in this programme, do you think that they would stoop to killing individual people who got in the way? We're just talking about them killing innocent people in Manchester, orchestrating things in the Middle East. Are they prepared to kill individuals by hacking their cars?
There was a guy called...
Is the Pope a Catholic?
Somebody called MK also mysteriously died in a strange car accident. Do you know who he was? MK was Vladimir Putin's driver.
Oh, indeed, yes, yes, that's right. And he just swerved onto the other side of the motorway in Moscow and crashed the car, as a professional driver.
On the Kotovsky Avenue, his car just swerved mysteriously, magnetised into the opposite carriageway. With Julian Assange, his lawyer is warning that US charges against him endanger press freedom worldwide, Martin. This is in Democracy Now. Mm-hmm. But the US is charging Assange, and it looks as if they want to bang him up, actually, doesn't it?
Well, some people in the US have called for him either to be assassinated or executed, so it's not just a question of banging him up, is it? The evil of these people and the lengths they're prepared to go to should be obvious by now to all but the purblind. Western intelligence services are way, way out of control. And we were talking earlier about what needs to be done about them. I would suggest that what needs to be done about them is pretty much what happened to the KGB after the fall of the Soviet Union. They've got to be completely dismantled and rebuilt from scratch. Same with the police service of Northern Ireland and the RUC or the armed forces in South Africa. You've just got to basically sack everybody, and some people get their jobs back, but most people won't.
It looks as if Ecuador is pretty much jettisoning Assange, even though he's still there. They're not helping him anymore. They say he must sort out his own issues with Britain and America.
Well, that's because the Ecuadorians are themselves under heavy manners from the Americans. Rafael Correa, who was the former president of Ecuador, he's had to leave Ecuador now because he's fallen out with Lenin Moreno, who's his successor. But Lenin Moreno has turned out to be a puppet of the Americans. So Correa, who used to be the president, of course, he couldn't stand for more than two terms. He's had to leave the country because he can't live under Moreno's regime. And Moreno has moved Ecuador back into the pro-US camp in Latin America, because there's basically a counter-revolution going on across Latin America, where through coup d'etat of various kinds, the far right are coming back to power, as they always were in the 1980s and into the 1990s. So at that point, Assange has bet on the wrong embassy to be in. He might have been better off in the Cuban embassy, eh?
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
I suppose we really ought to do this is looking at some of the manoeuvrings behind the scenes, potentially anyway, the people that are really controlling things, because we certainly don't seem to be getting much use from people like the Intelligence and Security Committee and the Prime Minister. And this is a chap called Joseph Wages. He's a Freemason himself, but he believes that there are Freemasons out there and people involved with Freemasonry, and not necessarily just that, other cults as well, because Freemasonry is a religious cult, who deliberately attempt to infiltrate politics and then to control things from behind the scenes. So let's see what Joseph Wages has to say.
In the actual Minerval degree, Illuminatus minor degree, Scottish novice, Scottish knight, the oaths that they're really swearing is that they're going to maintain inviolable secrecy. So the only ones that have like the so-called death penalty are the ones in the Masonic degrees itself. But those aren't unique to the Illuminati. They're kind of patterned off of Freemasonry. So if we look at it from a larger perspective, they're using Freemasonry as a vehicle for expansion. So the Illuminati's like subversion is less to do with civil society and more to do with Freemasonry. And I'm not saying that there's not a push towards global governance. You'd be a fool to say the opposite of that. And the ultimate idea is to impact and change the world for the better. So they're not advocating for the violent overthrow of governments per se, but what they're advocating for is the influence of government. So one of the things they say several times in the rituals is that you can overthrow a government and you'll get no change for the better, and more than likely than not the change for the worse. So the idea is for the heads of state, whether they be dukes or kings or princes or so forth, is to surround them with advisors educated in their system to prevent these people from making the wrong decisions or doing things that are not in the interest of the society and are maybe motivated by their own interest.
Well, there's a certain amount of sense in that, Martin, isn't there? Because if you have a revolution, you really don't know who's going to come out on top. Anybody could.
Well, I mean, and there's different kinds of meaning of the word revolution as well. I mean, change is obviously always going to be problematic when you've got powerful groups who want to steer everything in their own interest.
And anyway, there's a chap called David Livingstone. We had a clip from him a few weeks ago. He's got a new book coming out soon called Ordo Ab Chao, means order from chaos. And he's also a big believer, as I am, in the potential, anyway, for secret societies to be running things from behind the scenes. And this latest book is, as he's a convert to Islam, and he sees the Islam as the main target of these groups.
What they're trying to do is fulfill the Book of Revelation, right? So you and I, or most people, would read it and see the predictions as terrible things to happen. But since these guys are Luciferians, they see it backwards. So that's why it's a blueprint. So they believe that they need to fulfill the chaos that is prophesied in the Book of Revelation in order to accelerate the coming of the Messiah. And this is stated almost verbatim, or explicitly, by Alexander Dugin, who is really the architect of the Russian influence campaign in the United States. He basically says exactly that the Book of Revelation is not, he said that it's a task. It's a responsibility. And so they don't see, creating wars and destruction, famine, disease as a problem. They see it as a requirement that it's all part of the necessary stages that have to happen to bring about the coming of the Messiah. Their Messiah, so it's the Antichrist.
So, I mean, is it potential, Martin, that even though these things are sort of prophesied in the Book of Revelation, that people are looking at that book and saying, actually, that would be good, let's make this happen?
Well, there are people out there who take the Book of Revelation literally and are trying to implement it. I mean, the Christian Zionists in the US believe that they support Israel because they believe that there's going to be a final war, and then the Jews are going to convert to Christianity and the Messiah will come.
Those people
are not the generals in charge of the fighting.
They see that as a good thing. It's incredible.
Indeed they do, because that's the kind of thinking that you get when you believe in prophecy from books written in the Bronze
and
Age.
You would have thought that they wouldn't be actually trying to make this happen, surely.
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear that they do want to make it happen, but whether they would explain why
they don't want to negotiate with Iran, for example.
Well, indeed, because in actual fact they want a conflict. But whether they're the ones who are actually calling the shots is another matter. I think the people calling the shots are cynical, self-centred oligarchs, and they want what they want, and they use all this other stuff as a load of flim-flam to keep the masses where they want them.
Okay, finally tonight, let's have a listen to William Stewart, who we heard a couple of weeks ago, and his thoughts on the creation of Zionism. He believes it goes back to 1881.
So there you've got, something quite significant in 1881. You've got the war-making groups returning to Britain and then moving and strengthening their position in America. 1881, a new and very virulent form of Red Templar masonry was created, used to hide all the goings-on, and it was called the Ancient and Primitive Rite. Now, this was circulated in the Middle East, so we know that a war-making rite was added to all the other things that we've had in the Middle East since 1710, and the creation of the Muslim Brotherhood. So obviously the Muslim Brotherhood that is affected by this catches hold of the Ancient and Primitive Rite.
So the three groups that we know about, the Council of Foreign Relations, Bilderbergs, and the Trilateral Commission, you're saying is actually linked to a splinter group of the CIA?
Yes, I mean, as you know, CIA does good work for America. There are a lot of great patriots in it. They did some very good work. Some of them did some very good work around the time of 9/11, but unfortunately some of them did not. And what the Lombards do is they take our main institutions, including intelligence units, and they split them so that you've got what you know about and then something hidden underneath. The Fabians was a very good example of this, for instance. It had a utopian left wing on the outside, which founded the Labour Party. Inside, it was run by the most extreme radical, rancid bankers. the society of the elect. So you get the idea. And yes, there is a link between the splinter that they've created of the CIA and Rockefeller's relative who created the CIA, and then the Rockefeller groups, which are, as you say, Council of Foreign Relations, Bilderberg and Triarchic Commission.
Well, I'll let you get back to 1881. What else was significant?
Right, in 1881 too, so it was going on in 1882, begun in 1881, Baron Edmund Rothschild was working with what are called radical Zionists. Now, these are people who outwardly want the state of Israel to exist and to be reasonably right-wing. But Zionism itself can be traced back into the young movement of the Lombards. So, really speaking, 1881, Baron Edmund Rothschild met with Lombard planning for right-wing activity in the Middle East to try to set up, if you like, a young Israel or a right-wing Israel state. He contacted Rabbi Samuel, and I'll call him Rabbi Samuel because I can't even begin to pronounce the second name, but he's Rabbi Samuel. Rabbi Samuel was expecting Armageddon, that's the Seventh War, a final battle of Armageddon to take place, after which a new nation, Israel, would arise and conquer all the areas around it as found in the Old Testament. And I have to ask you what Mr. Rothschild, banker, was doing, organizing in such a volatile region with people who actually wanted Armageddon. Now, I put in the book there are other rabbis and so forth on the same tack. But of course, we are dealing with a radical organization which is banker-based. It is nothing to do with the state of Israel. And those are perfectly genuine, good, nice people in Israel who have nothing to do with this. Now, we have to return a little bit and try to fit these things together. In 1881, Western bankers began to take control of the Ottoman Empire. And don't forget, there's the Ottoman Empire, that the breakup of it by the Muslim Brotherhood, owned by our bankers, that caused World War I. Then the war-making round table, which we've talked very briefly about, which was the Lombards coming back to Britain and going to America, having been kicked out of Britain. They were fresh from causing the Boer War and the Russian Revolution a bit later on. They took charge of the process of creating the State of Israel at the Paris Peace Conference of 2nd of November 1919. And it was called the Balfour Declaration, after somebody who was sort of attached, as it were, to the British government. But unfortunately, the bankers were using the Milner Round Table, the one that did the Boer War and later the Russian Revolution and so on, to create the State of Israel. And this truth did not come out until the 21st of July 1936, as released by parliamentarian Ormsby Gore. So you tell me what the war makers were doing setting up a state of Israel that wanted and expected Armageddon being founded by the most profound war makers on earth.
That was William Stewart, his book The Secret College, 9/11 to Armageddon. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. Thanks to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
For Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.